Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. I'm Elizabeth Slattery, Vice President of Practice Groups. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. Now please enjoy today's conversation.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar. Today, July 13th, 2026, we are delighted to host a conversation entitled Accreditation of Higher Education, a Primer. My name is Emma Blakemore, and I am an Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. In the interest of time, I'll keep the introductions brief, but if you would like to know more about any of our panelists, you can access their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have Robert S. Eitel, Jonathan Helwink, and Adam Kissel as our panelists, with Sarah Parshall Perry as our moderator. Mr. Eitel is co-founder and president of the Defense of Freedom Institute. Mr. Helwink is principal at Helwink Legal Group, PLLC. Mr. Kissel is visiting lecturer in formal organizations at Trinity College. And Ms. Perry is vice president and senior legal fellow at Defending Education. And I will leave it there. One last note throughout the panel, if you have any questions, please submit them through the question and answer feature so that we will have access to them when we get to that portion of the webinar. And we do ask that questions submitted there both pertain to this discussion and end with a question mark. With that, thank you for being with us today. And I will turn things over to Ms. Perry to start the conversation.
Thank you, Emma, and thanks to my great panelists for joining me today and for those of you who've joined online. Accreditation is suddenly a very sexy topic of conversation, probably for the first time since the accreditation process was institutionalized through the Department of Education's Higher Education Act. So we're going to talk today a little bit about some of the specific mechanics involved, what's at stake, where we see accreditors potentially crossing the legal line into indoctrination, what kind of power they wield. But I'm going to do a little bit of table setting before we jump into the discussion. As always, feel free, as Emma said, to drop your questions in the chat feature for Q&A, and we'll be taking those throughout the course of today's webinar. So the United States does not have a centralized Ministry of Education, as a lot of other nations do. Instead, we have more of a decentralized regulatory triad. Now, that consists of accrediting agencies, state licensing authorities, and a certification process by the Department of Education itself. And this accreditation process is very fundamental to the participation in federal student aid procedures. So for any one of the nation's 6,000 institutions of higher education to be eligible for federal student loans or any other form of funding, they have to be accredited by a federally recognized accrediting agency, something that the U.S. Department of Education considers a feasible, reliable imprimatur of the quality of a college or graduate school education. And as gatekeepers of federal financial aid, accreditors obviously have very great sway over the institutions that they accredit. They, in fact, with the federal statutory authority granted to them, can implement particular perspectives and ways of doing business that may or may not be the best for higher education. The Department of Education also has great power over those agencies. In fact, in 2023, President Trump called accreditation his secret weapon for reshaping higher education in the mold that he preferred. And to that end, he issued Executive Order 14279, which was titled Reforming Accreditation to Strengthen Higher Education on April 23rd of 2025. He declared a revolution in accreditation. Again, accreditation for many of us is sort of a sleepy topic, but again, it is getting quite a bit of notoriety this year. But pursuant to that executive order, the Ed Department has recently finalized negotiated rulemaking on new accreditation regulations and intends to publish a final rule by November of this year or thereabouts. But what's the purpose of accreditation? How much actual power do accreditors hold? What's that mechanism, the connection to federal funding, and how are determinations of academic quality actually made? And are those determinations trustworthy? Do the current accreditation processes and recognized agencies meet their stated aims and responsibilities? And what's the role of NESICI, the Department of Education's National Advisory Committee for Institutional Quality and Integrity? Can the public expect to see the department's new accreditation regulations fundamentally change higher education? And to what extent, if at all, can the department use its recognition authority over accreditors to effectively address issues like campus free speech, academic freedom, DEI, civil rights violations, and other controversial issues? So today we're going to dive into some of those nuts and bolts and what the process means for higher education in America today. So let me begin with Bob. I want to ask you specifically, Bob, what the accreditation process is and that triad that we referenced earlier in the introductory remarks.
Sure. So let me just preface this with just some preliminary understandings of the accreditation agencies. It's important, I think, to remember that The accreditation agencies have existed, many of them, for over a century. The major institutional agencies that historically have been based on a regional basis date from 1885, 1895, 1898, 1917, 1919. And so there is a history for these entities that pre-exists the Federal Student Loan Program and the Pell Grant Program. In the late 19th century, voluntary associations of post-secondary institutions formed to define the differences between secondary education and higher education and to develop a mutual standard for peer review as a condition of membership. These overturned and turned into regional associations of colleges and universities whose membership was contingent upon this accreditation. And the associations developed these accrediting bodies or commissions that were responsible for developing standards, mutually agreeable standards on the institutional qualifications for membership. So by the 1970s, all, if not most, degree-granting institutions of higher ed were either accredited or applicants for accreditation. So I think it's important to remember during this conversation that these entities have a long history prior to their involvement in the Federal Student Loan Program. They didn't just spring up with the rise of the Higher Education Act in 1965. The purpose, the role of accreditation in higher education, therefore, has to serve as a marker of acceptable quality of an educational program or school. And it is a voluntary, and I want to stress, a voluntary means of conducting non-governmental peer evaluation of colleges and universities and their programs through an assessment of the quality of the programs at the IHE, the Institution for Higher Education, and in creating a culture of continuous improvement of academic quality at colleges and universities. So in the context of federal student lending and Pell Grants, accreditation, as you said, is the academic quality assurance and improvement guarantee, or at least it's supposed to be. You mentioned the triad. So there is a triad that exists the United States, as you know, eschews administrative education. It pursues a decentralized approach for the regulation of higher ed. There is no Ministry of Education. And instead, we have this triad of state licensing entities, accreditation agencies, and the Education Department. Each one of these authorizers has a very deep vein of compliance. So, for instance, the state license, it's the foundation for everything. People often forget that. In order to obtain, for an institution to obtain institutional accreditation, it has to have a state license to confer post-secondary degrees. Once it gets that, it can then obtain a institutional accreditation from a Department of Education recognized institutional accreditation agency. And then once it gets that, it has to apply separately to the Department of Education itself to be certified to participate in Title IV. This is a very arduous and lengthy process, and I'll give you a concrete example of that. The University of Austin. The University of Austin was announced by its founders in November of 2021. It applied for a state license from Texas in 2022. It got that license at the end of 2023, and it has now applied for accreditation from an accreditor. And that accreditation process will not be completed until the spring of 2028. So this is a 7-year process for the University of Austin to be in a posture simply to ask the Department of Education to participate in Title IV. So there's there are very high entries, high barriers to entry for a new higher education entity. That's a perfect example of it. Before I get into the department's process, I would like to just make some clarification as to the types of accreditation agencies, because I think that very often people confuse them, and it's particularly important in the law school context, the ABA accreditation context. So there's two general types of accreditors. There's institutional accreditation agencies, and there are programmatic accreditation agencies. The U.S. Department of Education recognizes both. Institutional accreditors are those which grant accreditation to an entire institution. You may see writings that refer to regional accreditation agencies or national accrediting agencies, but that nomenclature was done away with in 2019 during the first Trump administration, when it did its first overhaul of the accreditation regulations. The regionals historically were concentrated on specific regions of the country. The national accreditation agencies were focused usually on career training programs and sort of had operated across the United States. Because they're both institutional in nature, the Trump administration did away with that nomenclature and authorized all so-called regional agencies to accredit institutions across the country. That was a very significant reform. The second type of agency is programmatic, and sometimes they're referred to as specialized accreditors. And they operate nationwide, and they review programs within institutions such as engineering, technology, law, medicine, allied health. In many instances, particular programs that are accredited by a programmatic accreditor, while the institution in which the program is offered is accredited by an institutional accrediting agency. And so what I mean by that is, so for instance, the most law students do not receive, law schools, with the exception of freestanding law schools, are able to offer federal financial aid to law students through their institutional accreditor, not the ABA. There's an exception to that, and that pertains to freestanding law schools, where the ABA is both the institutional and the programmatic accreditor for the freestanding law school. So for instance, Ave Maria Law School in Florida, it relies upon the ABA to be both an institutional and a programmatic accreditor.
And there aren't many of those, about 15 or so.
That's correct. There's about 15, I think it's maybe 5,000 students, but it's very important to those institutions because it presents an existential threat if they were to lose that recognition from the ABA in terms of their institutional accreditation status. So let me get to your question. What is the role of the Department of Education? So the department, as I said, it has a certification, T4 certification element, but it also has this recognition of accreditation agencies element as well. This federal recognition authority has existed actually since the 1950s. It started in 1952 with the passage of the Korean GI Bill of 1952 and was followed up again with the National Defense Education Act of 1958. And these statutes basically said that institutions in receipt of GI bills had to be accredited by a federally recognized accreditor. And in those days, it was something called the Office of the U.S. Commissioner of Education. When the Higher Education Act of 1965 was passed, and new federal programs were student aid programs were initiated regardless of veteran status, again, Congress directed the Office of the U.S. Commissioner of Education to maintain this list of approved accreditors. In 1980, the Education Department took this over with the passage and creation of the Department of Education Organization Act. And the department has had the responsibility for this recognition of agencies since that time. Between 1965 and the early 90s, the HEA did not have a lot of criteria for recognition. This began to change. I won't get into the details of it, but in 1992, Congress directed the department to tighten its oversight of accreditation agencies in several ways and has only added to those responsibilities over the years. I should add that the Higher Education Act expressly states that nothing in the act shall be construed to permit the secretary to establish criteria that's not listed in the HEA. So there is, and we can talk about this later in the webinar, there is some latitude for agencies to establish criteria outside of those listed statutorily. So here's the process. The Department of Education has an Office of Post-Secondary Education that maintains a unit called the Accreditation Group to handle this recognition responsibility and to apply the department's regulations to applications for recognition. And the process is generally as follows. An agency or an entity that wants to be a recognized agency will submit a petition for initial recognition or renewed recognition with a department. That is not simply a plea. We're not dealing with notice pleading here. This is think in terms of a motion for summary judgment at the tail end of a seven-year securities case. Lots of documentation, lots of work, many years of toil to get to that point to be able to apply to the department for particularly initial recognition, but even renewed recognition. The department's documentation demands are pretty extensive. The accreditation staff will then solicit comments from the public. You'll see something in the Federal Register in that regard occasionally, asking for public comments on either a new accreditor or those who wish to renew their recognition. The accreditation unit will then review the application and the comments. They will prepare a draft staff report. They will provide that to the entity that is applying for recognition. They will have the opportunity to make comments, to provide criticisms of the staff report. And the accreditation unit will then prepare a final staff analysis, and they would include a recommended action for the department. And then they would submit it to what is called the National Advisory Committee for Institutional Quality and Integrity, or NASIQI. The NASIQI is statutorily created by the HEA, and they are to advise the secretary on a number of matters related to accreditation, particularly for decisions on whether to recognize or not recognize an agency. The HEA requires the NASIQI to meet not less than twice a year. I am a member, as is my colleague Adam Kissel. This year we'll be meeting three times. That's unusual, but there's a heavy docket. There's 18 members. Six are appointed by the Secretary of Education. Six are appointed by the Speaker, with three from the minority, three from the majority, and then six from the President pro temp of the Senate, with three from the majority, three from the minority. We serve six-year terms. They're staggered. NASIKI will then review the materials, review the record, the administrative record, and then provide, ask questions of the applicants, representatives, and then vote, and then send a recommendation based on that vote to what is called the senior department official, who then makes the decision on whether to grant the application or to deny it or to impose some other conditions. If the applicant is unhappy with the decision of the SDO, they have the right to apply to seek an appeal to the Secretary of Education, who will then render a decision, a final agency decision, which in turn is subject to judicial review. So the aggrieved applicant may go to federal district court to overturn the decision, final agency decision of the agency. That the procedural history rarely happens, but it has happened in the past, and most recently, several years ago, at the tail end of the Obama administration and beginning of the Trump administration, there was an accreditor that lost its recognition, sued federal district court, directed the department to redo its review. It was restored. And so that occasionally will happen. That in a nutshell is the procedure. I'm going to stop here and let others talk. I could talk about this all day, but I will spare you additional discussion from Leanne.
I do want to talk a little bit about what just transpired, right? So we just saw the completion of what's called AIM negotiated rulemaking. And that's accreditation, innovation, and modernization. It just completed. But I want to turn to Jonathan, and I want to talk a little bit about what the result of that negotiated rulemaking actually was and what we're seeing in the draft regulations.
Yeah, thanks, Sarah, and excellent intro to a pretty complicated topic, accreditation and recognition. So the negotiated rulemaking that just ended in late May of this year really was born out of what Sarah mentioned in her introduction, which was Executive Order 14279, reforming accreditation. And essentially what the executive order did is it kind of set the policy tone for accreditation in the second Trump administration. Things like accreditors doing something about low performing institutions. And that generally means like low graduation rates or poor performance of graduates in the job market, low to no return on investment for graduates who took student loans, DEI initiatives, and what the administration's policy is going to be towards those accreditation standards. And then calls out specifically the ABA as one of the agencies that is going to be under the microscope in the second Trump administration. So AIM is announced with the purpose of enacting Executive Order 14279. You heard that President Trump refers to accreditation as a secret weapon. The Undersecretary of Education, Nicholas Kent, that's the senior department official who's in charge of higher education policy. He's the political head of FSA. He routinely refers to the revolution in accreditation. And I think we see what that accreditation revolution is actually going to look like in the AIM negotiations and in the draft language. Now, a lot of this builds off of work that was done in the first Trump administration, but goes far beyond the kind of things that we were working on in the first Trump administration. So what are some of the most important elements of the negotiated rulemaking and now draft text of the regulations? And what did the committee decide? We'll talk about how this is a consensus regulation and what that could really mean, both in the context of negotiated rulemaking, which is already kind of a unique facet in federal rulemaking at the Department of Education, and also what this administration has generally done with consensus rulemaking, because they haven't had a non-consensus rulemaking yet. So we have a pretty good sample size of the way that they treat consensus language. So let's go through the most important bits and then talk about the effect of consensus. The first, and probably the most impactful for accreditation agencies. Is it going to be most impactful for students? I don't necessarily think so. I think that's another provision. I think there are other kind of larger issues that will have an impact beyond accreditation. But for the agencies themselves, the most impactful provisions have to do with expanding the responsibilities of accreditation agencies and the standards that are required by the department for recognition, that recognition that Bob was talking about just a second ago. So what are the kind of things we were thinking about? Well, frankly, probably the core aspect, or at least one of the core aspects of Trump 2's approach to higher education is metrics, achievement metrics, return on investment metrics. And one of the things that AIM does is integrate student achievement metrics into the standards that accreditors are going to be held to. So that includes accreditors requiring an analysis of earnings data. So that's a huge part of this administration's approach to higher ed and ensuring that the loans that students are taking to attend institutions of higher education are actually making them better off. Accreditors, by virtue of the AIM regulations, are now part of that effort. There are provisions that require faculty evaluation, that require the accreditors to look into intellectual diversity issues and viewpoint assessments on campus. Certainly, and this should come as no surprise, eliminating diversity standards. That's a huge thing for this administration. And we could talk about the real kind of pragmatic impacts of that. I think it's one thing to talk about specific agencies and the impact of these diversity statements and required diversity elements, whereas others had removed a lot of their diversity requirements last year, long before these regulations were proposed. We can talk about that in a moment. One of the most controversial issues at the negotiation table was First Amendment and civil rights policies that accreditors are now, according to those who I guess don't really think this is a great idea, where the accreditors are now policing whether or not institutions are respecting First Amendment principles on campus. To be perfectly frank, I think that's a bit of an overstatement. I think the department was very careful about how they approached academic freedom. But I think, look, as a conservative, you look at those kind of issues and the federal government getting involved in those issues on campus, you say to yourself, maybe this isn't such a hot idea, but certainly we can talk about it. And then also research misconduct. There are standards now for accreditors to look into research misconduct on campus. So that's the first kind of bucket, expanding responsibilities for accreditors. The second is this is a especially wonky issue, but it has a huge impact. And it's the separate and independent status, otherwise known as conflicts of interest. So when it comes to especially programmatic accreditors, they are often very closely related, if not a part of, some sort of trade organization. And we don't have to call any out, but there's often a very close relationship between the trade association and the accreditor. And it doesn't take long to figure out that a trade association and an accreditor have really kind of disparate goals in mind. You know, one is trying to protect their members and the other is trying to increase membership. And that right. those aren't necessarily things that work together necessarily. And in the middle of all of that is students. And one thing that this administration and folks from Trump One were also concerned about is credential inflation. In other words, in the name of protecting membership, these trade associations increased requirements for entry. So like, for instance, instead of an associate degree, you had to get a bachelor's degree. Instead of a bachelor's degree, you had to get a master's degree in order to minimize the number of new individuals coming into the trade association and thereby reducing wages, essentially, yeah, to put it frankly. So in the end, what ends up happening through all of this is credential inflation and students taking on more student debt. The administration has decided to do something about that. So in the effort to reduce the conflict of interest between trade associations and the accrediting agencies, they put a prohibition on what they call shared resources. So what is that kind of stuff? Office space. Accreditors and trade associations can't share office space anymore. Financial autonomy. The accreditors, programmatic accreditors, have to be financially autonomous from the trade association. There's restrictions on affiliated organizations. There's restrictions on who could be members of the public when it comes to accreditors. You know, the purpose here is to try to separate out these two entities that at times, not at all times, but at times have conflicting interests that lead to students with higher student loan debt. Number three, and I actually think, you know, given my experience at a community college, that's how I started my career in higher ed as a community college professor. I think that the switching of the presumption, the reversing of the presumption on transfer credits is one of the most impactful provisions of this entire rulemaking. So my students, I'll just tell you a story of my students. My students at the community college would take 2 years of college credit and then transfer to another institution. Now, our students were lucky because most of the students who transferred to other institutions that had articulation agreements. And what that means is that there's just an agreement between two institutions that up to a certain amount of credits will automatically be accepted. But those are the exceptions, not the rule. For a lot of students, when they transfer to another institution, they lose credits. So you might want to transfer with 60 credits. The accepting institution says, you know what, these 10 credits aren't up to our standards. So therefore, you have to take those 10 credits again. Well, 10 credits is a semester. And that pushes you farther away from completion. That pushes up your student loan balance. Look, are all these classes exactly the same? They're not. But remember what the administration is interested in. The administration is interested in reducing student loan debt. This is a part of that effort, and it's the student who benefits. The way that it does that is by reversing the presumption. So moving forward, the presumption will be that the credits do transfer and that the institution actually has to provide a written basis for a denial. It was often the opposite in my experience, that the presumption is that the credits would not transfer absent an articulation agreement. So it's kind of a big deal. Finally, it's the reducing barriers to new accreditors and switching accreditors, institutions that want to switch between accreditors. There are provisions baked into these regs to make that process that Bob talked about a moment ago go from 5 years, maybe a little bit closer to two, maybe even less than that. The idea being that it's possible that institutions remain with their formerly regional accreditors because it's too hard to switch. But if it was a little easier, maybe we could have more competition in the marketplace. That came up a lot in negotiations, that there should be more competition between accreditors for institutional membership. So that includes things like accelerated initial accreditation. There's a lot of agencies that have applications in front of the department that have taken a very, very long time to act on it. And in many cases, the department just hasn't acted on that. You're probably aware of state law provisions that are requiring institutions to switch accreditors in every cycle. You know, prior to these rules, that is a nightmare. And by the time that you gain accreditation, you'd have to work on switching accreditors because it takes so very long to do that. The idea in these regs for this provision is to try to pull back some of those requirements.
There seems to be a real...
I have more to say on the consensus, but I do want to hand it off to Adam.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting. I want to ask you one sort of summary question, and I think I can anticipate the answer, but based on everything that you've laid out and what we've seen in negotiated rulemaking, is do you think that Undersecretary Kent's characterization of this as a revolution in higher education, in accreditation, is an accurate one?
It's so funny. The revolution will be published in the Federal Register. It's hard to say that because for me, this is a regulatory process and I'm just kind of used to it. But when you think about the potential long-term impacts, you know, in 5 years, in 10 years of these regs, will accreditation look differently if these regs stand the test of time? I think the answer is absolutely yes.
Yeah. I would agree with that. Adam, let me turn to you next. We recognize the fact that accreditors, and in many respects, those specific programmatic accreditors aren't bias-free. They're subject to many of the profession's ideological preferences. So I want to talk with you a little bit about some of the outsized influence that these accrediting agencies have over things, for example, like diversity, equity, and inclusion, right? And we've seen the Trump administration go toe-to-toe with a number of universities, specifically Harvard, seems to be in the administration's crosshairs repeatedly. But talk a little bit about what can happen with the influence of these accreditors over the actual governance and inclusions on higher education campuses.
Thank you, Sarah. Before the regional accreditors became national, they operated as a cartel or almost like the gangs of a city. Each one had its own turf. And when you have your own turf, you can abuse your power. The institutional accreditors were outmatched in their abuse of power only by the programmatic accreditors, for whom there also was monopoly power in many cases, or a duopoly at best. And when you're the only option for professional licensing or for Title IV access, you have a tendency to abuse your power. And there's three ways that accreditors of both kinds can and have done that. One is through the standards themselves. So if you go to any accreditor's website, it will have a number of pages worth of the standards that any accredited body has got to meet. Two, there are visiting teams. So when it's time to get accredited, a bunch of people who are from your supposedly peer institutions come and investigate how you're doing. And whatever the standards say, the visiting team might have some different questions. Even if DEI is not in the standards, the visiting team might say, well, tell us about the DEI, and that might not be good enough for us. And their report on you as the program or the institution might have some dings in it. And then third, are investigations and the whole disciplinary process. So you might already have your accreditation and think you're going along fine. And then you do something that comes to the attention of the accreditor, and they start an investigation or a disciplinary process. So accreditors have a floor of a minimum list of topics that they evaluate you on. That comes out of 20 USC 1099B. Very general things like curricula, faculty, student support services. The department can regulate up to a point under paragraph A of that, but that ability is undermined from some other parts of 1099B, so it's not as clear-cut what the department can do. And there's what gets called the elastic clause. So other than those 10 things that are very general that every accreditor has to judge you on, it says add any other standards you want. which makes sense because these are private institutions, private associations that want to decide what quality means.
Sure.
But a lot of them added DEI and to a fault. So if you want to see a lot of examples of those faults, the politicization of higher education accreditation is the title of a Texas Public Policy Foundation piece that Tim Rosenberger and I put together, cataloging a lot of violations. And for this audience, why don't we just talk about the ABA? So programmatic accreditor, ABA has its own accreditation arm. That's what we're talking about. There's a member of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, former member Gail Harriet. She reported in 2022 on some surveys of law schools and medical schools. I'll quote her somewhat at length. 31% of law schools, 24% of medical schools reported feeling pressure to take race into account in making admissions decisions. This is obviously before Students for Fair Admissions, but the accreditors were saying do this or else. In the mid-2010s, with the help of the National Association of Scholars, Gail Harriet surveyed state medical schools, and out of the 16 that responded, half had been cited by their accreditor, which in that case was the Liaison Committee on Medical Education, for having insufficient diversity. And then Harriet turns to the ABA. The ABA, over many years, coerced George Mason University's law school, I'll name a name, now it's the Scalia Law School, beginning in 2000, because the site evaluation team was unhappy that only 6.5% of the entering day students were minorities. GMU said, we have admission standards. We refuse to use racial preferences. But the ABA said, no, we're not going to renew your accreditation. So, of course, GMU had to back down. Monopoly power was effective. And it took 6 years for that process to play out, just in time for the next round of the 7-year review, where the next visiting team dinged GMU Law School again for not having enough diversity. So what happened to Black students at GMU Law because of ABA's pressure and capitulation by the law school? Well, from 2003 to 2005, 45% of the Black law students experienced academic failure, as opposed to only 4% of students from other races. And so the ABA continued to do things like this, not just to GMU, but to the rest of the country. So if, for instance, California said you cannot engage in racial preferences in admissions, the ABA said, we don't care. You have to figure out a way to do it anyway, against state law. So it was so bad that even the American Law Deans Association complained that the ABA inappropriately inserts itself into the internal affairs of the institutions it accredits in a way that forces homogeneity and conversely, this is quoting them, conversely stifles innovation and diversity among law schools. So that those are some areas where the rubber meets the road on abuse of power. Now, in terms of mandating DEI training of students, I turned to the Council of Social Work Education, and again, you can find at length their very long set of standards about anti-racism as a mandatory topic for teaching social workers. But I've got to quote it to you because I'll quote some of it to you. Social workers understand how racism and oppression shape human experiences and how these two constructs influence practice at the individual, family, group, organizational, and community levels, and in policy and research. So basically, DEI is the overriding concept for how you do policy, how you do research, how you do practice as a social worker. Continuing, social workers understand the pervasive impact of white supremacy and privilege and use their knowledge, awareness, and skills to engage in anti-racist practice. That was 2021. It's basically still there in 2025. Quoting them now, an anti-racist and anti-oppressive perspective underpinned the explicit and implicit curriculum and framed the profession's commitment to respect all people and the quest for social, racial, economic, and environmental justice. So that's social work. Like it or not, if you want to be accredited by the CSWE, those are the rules for your curriculum, your practice, your teaching, your research, your policy. There is, in addition to the education department, I'll just expand back out. In addition to the education department, there's a private association that also recognizes accreditors called the Council for Higher Education Accreditation, CHEA. And in 2021, their standard 3.A was the institution must demonstrate that it manifests a commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion. in 2025, that's been changed under pressure from the Trump administration and whatever other forces. Now, like many other, like many of the accreditors, it has weakened its DEI standard or suspended it. In this case, the new language is the institution values professional integrity and broad representation by fostering a culture of fairness, openness, and respect within its own operations. So what does that mean? Well, you can wink and say still means DEI, or you can say, oh, we've changed it. It's not coming back. Yet to be litigated, yet to be regulated. We'll figure out accreditor by accreditor where they really stand, especially in future administrations, if some of these changes don't really get baked in. And last thing I'll mention is about governance. And I've got to name the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools accreditation arm for three really quick examples that come out of this same report. So in 2023, University of North Carolina voted to create a new civic school. And that came to the attention of the head of SACS, which is the former regional accreditor for the Southeast. And of course, starting a new school is within the prerogatives of a board, but SACS said, we're going to get them to change that or they're going to be on warning with us, because she didn't like it, because it was an ideological decision, in my opinion. A couple years earlier at Florida State University, there was a presidential search. A candidate for the president was also on the governing board. By state law, he had to be. But SACS said, oh, you're too close to the process. You should step down, which would have violated Florida law. And then in the third example, also in 2021, there was a chancellor search at the University System of Georgia. So again, we're talking about interfering in governance. I should have prefaced that. SACS interferes and says, well, the former governor might not be close enough to the process to deserve to be the next chancellor. So on the one hand, if she doesn't like the Republican legislator or former legislator in Florida, she's going to say you're too close to the process. And if she doesn't like you because you're too far from the process, but it's really because you're a Republican legislator or governor, you're also going to get dinged and investigated. So you can't win either way. Now, I should say that after a lot of attention came to this, the institutions pretty much got to do what they wanted. SACS is now changing its name, has a new president, and SACS may have turned a corner, but they have a lot of history of abusing their power. So if you don't mind me turning in my last couple minutes to some solutions, if maybe, Sarah, that's where you were going to go next.
Yes. In fact, one of the things I was also going to say is we've got a question from the audience about whether or not you would be willing to link through both your piece and the Gail Harriet piece that you mentioned as well. So when you're complete, drop that in the chat and I can answer that question directly. But what are some of these solutions that you are basically setting up for us, recognizing that there is an ideological funnel through which accrediting agencies can push their preferred narratives?
Sure. And so, of course, the NCREG already is covering some of these in some really important ways, and probably in some more important ways than the sexy DEI topic, as Jonathan and Bob were talking about. But easiest one is crackdown from a civil rights perspective. If the accreditor is forcing an institution or a program to violate state or federal law because of racial preferences in hiring or admissions, you should go after them, you meaning the appropriate authorities. Two is there are state laws. So in Florida, Florida said you can't have DEI even if the accreditor makes you. And so push comes to shove. The accreditor says you must. The state says you must not. In these cases, the accreditors have backed down. So CSWE said, oh, in Florida, you don't have to follow those DEI rules. We give up. And so we haven't seen the push come to shove really yet. Third, the competition principle is now that there's somewhat more competition, especially at the institutional level, it's make sure that that competition can really happen. There's default to your former regional accreditor. So in a number of states, it says your accreditor must be the former regional accreditor. So you've got to change the state law to say anyone who's approved, who's recognized by the U.S. Department of Education, or maybe CHEA also, counts for our state. So that means an audit of all the rules and regulations, laws, occupational licensing standards to make them generic instead of name a particular accreditor, and every state's going to have to do its own audit that way and figure it out. Fourth is start a new accreditor. A number have started, so increasing the competition. So if you don't like the rules of your accreditor, you can change your accreditor. And making that real, you really can, especially if you're a public institution in a number of states that have become part of the new Commission for Public Higher Education, which probably in a couple of years will get recognized by the U.S. Department of Education as a reliable accreditor. But I also make this recommendation, say, for Catholic social work programs. If you're being told you can't be Catholic, start your own accreditor with a few of your like-minded Catholic social work program friends. It's easier than you think. It's not easy, but it's easier than you think. Takes a while, but you can do it. And then if you're the state bar of a state, maybe some folks are thinking about Supreme Court of their own state, you can say the ABA no longer is the one authority. We decide as the Supreme Court or some other entity who is allowed to operate as a law school. So those are my four or five ideas for reform in addition to the NCREG.
And to that point, Adam, we've already seen Alabama, Texas, and Florida divest themselves of the ABA. We've already seen Tennessee Supreme Court make inroads to that effect. We've submitted, our organization has submitted a formal comment there. And now Ohio has done the exact same thing. So now we've seen five states who are willing to reconsider whether or not a voluntary membership association is more appropriately positioned to sort of determine the quality of legal education, or whether or not it's going to be the judges of the courts in which those individuals will practice in front of. The downstream effect of, I think, this accreditation revolution is apparent in the fact that now the ABA has said specifically they are going to reconsider whether or not they want to continue utilizing standard 303C. And that was the one that required mandatory bias, cross-cultural competency, and anti-racism training at 2 points in a student's legal education. And they've opened that up for comment. The comment window just briefly closed a few days ago. But I think now that they've suspended standard 206, which was related to demonstrated commitments to diversity in admissions and in hiring as well, we're seeing a lot of this impact, I think, in a real sort of fundamental way by these modifications of a process that has largely been rubber stamped, I think, for the American Bar Association. Dave has a question here, and I want to pose this to Jonathan. What do we expect? What do we expect the rules from rulemaking to be published? And is there going to be an opportunity for public comment?
So, yeah, great question. So the rules will likely be published before November 1st. Of this year. That's the finalized rule. Now, the HEA requires kind of a weird notice and comment variation for regulations related to Title IV. That we call that negotiated rulemaking, which is essentially negotiations by the committee. That's what was completed in May of this year that reached consensus. And then once the department publishes a proposed rule, what we call an NPRM, they'll open up the process for public comment, generally speaking, for 30 days. After the public comment period is closed, the department reviews all of the comments and then publishes a final rule. If that final rule is published before November 1st of this year, the master calendar requirements in the Higher Education Act mean that the rule would become effective July 1 of 2027. That's the beginning of the next award year. That's just kind of how the regs work. Despite the fact that there's fewer people in the department than there were when any of us were there, they have been extremely effective in getting rules out at a very, very quick rate. I wouldn't be surprised to see an NPRM published later this month, maybe early next month. In fact, I think that's probably what the schedule is.
Yeah, I'll just add to that if I could.
Please.
It's a certainty it will be published in August, most likely early August. The department will give 30 days for the public to provide written comments. And they will have a final regulation published by November 1st for the reasons that Jonathan just articulated. So it'll be effective by July 1st, 2027. Do not underestimate the importance of having a year and a half to implement the regulation.
This yes. is
a situation where they're going to publish, you know, in an election year and they're, you know, could be gone 6 months, 6 months later. They will have 18 months to implement and apply this regulation and make this thing stick. And I got to tell you, if I'm an accreditor and I'm looking at this package, I'm going to have a very, very busy couple of years. I see organizational restructuring that will need to occur, changes in the composition of the board, critical governance questions. You know, there's this whole question of antitrust that we didn't get into, where
yeah.
the department has made a big thing about the antitrust aspects of this. I would get a compliance program into place. And not the least of which is a whole exercise in reviewing my standards, policies, and procedures to ensure that they comply. They have a boatload of work to do. I have to say, I wonder if I should go back into private practice and do accreditation law, because there's a lot to do out there. I envy you, Jonathan.
So we're looking at what, a 30-day comment period? Is it sort of 30 to 60 days? I know the Administrative Procedure Act, which governs rulemaking like this, requires a minimum, I believe, of 30 days, but sometimes the agencies will expand them to 60 or 90 days. What do we anticipate we'll see, Jonathan?
30, period.
Okay, that's important for everyone who's listening in to know, because there will be a lot of people who will want to comment on this for understandable reasons.
They won't have the time otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah. So I have got another question, and this one I want to pose to Adam. Is it advisable to lobby state legislators to implement state laws to resist accreditors that revert to DEI measures with a new, more sort of DEI-accepting administration assumes power? In other words, can we legislate at the state level to backstop what we might see in a sort of newly minted NAESQE under a future administration?
I would use the word lobby, definitely encourage that kind of policy to ensure that the state can have the kinds of public and private institutions that it wants in its state using its part of the triad. It can tie whatever, I'm not going to say whatever, but quite a lot to its authorization power, as well as whatever its regulator does and whatever state law does.
One more question, and I want to pose this to the group. I'm curious as to all of your thoughts. We got a very sort of, I think, interesting question about competition between accreditors. This is a big part of the negotiated rulemaking and what we've seen, eliminating regulatory burdens, but also increasing opportunities for accreditation so that you don't have such a high hurdle to get over before you can really develop these sort of competitive processes and make higher education as a general proposition more rigorous overall with a better ROI. Someone's waited with a question: with competition between accreditors, what would prevent a race to the bottom as opposed to a race to the top? What say you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting point. And I'll just tell you that exact phrase came up on the very first day of negotiations with the committee. And I can tell you, despite one or two voices that raised that point, the rest of the committee, including the department, just rejected the notion, essentially out of hand, that when you look at all the standards that an accreditor has to satisfy, when you look at all of the requirements and all the hoops that an accreditor has to jump through, the idea that at the end of this entire process will essentially be an overnight accreditor that's just handing out access to Title IV, you know, willy-nilly, I don't see that as a possibility. There's so many folks who have to look at an application, who have to approve an application, and then, you know, another level of folks who have to approve that approval of the application. I just don't see it as a reasonable outcome that would, you know, if you open up the doors a little bit to new accreditors, that there's going to be this race to the bottom. And the department feels the exact same way. And I think if you actually dug into the accreditation regulations and then not only like the new standards, but in some ways the standards that are now more difficult to satisfy than they were before.
Right.
I wouldn't call that a race to the bottom.
I would agree. And as someone who has two in college right now with a third on the way, I am very, very pleased to see a return on investment provision in the negotiated rulemaking. I would like to know that my children will be gainfully employed after they finish their college careers. But with that, I will toss it back to Emma, who's going to close us out.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. And I also want to thank our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, please keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about upcoming virtual events. Thank you all so much for joining today, and we are adjourned.
Thanks for listening to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. To learn more, visit our website, fedsoc.org.